All right. 155. You guys ready? Okay, I know you just ate, but have a little more excitement. You guys ready?
Yeah.
Okay, that's better. All right. No food coma. It's a problem with having a session right after lunch. Everybody's in a food coma. No napping. All right. All right, so I like to treat these as a kind of more of a user group. I mean, let's be interactive. Let's have some fun. Make sure you're in the right sessions. We are going to talk about hybrid and SQL Server 2016. Okay. Let's begin. So I look exactly like that. That's my contact information. So any of the scripts I have, the deck, or if you have any questions, feel free to reach out to me. I'm happy to send you all the scripts, all the information we're going to talk about today. Okay. All right. So when we say hybrid, what are we talking about? What does hybrid mean? Yeah, a mixture of environment. But in case of Microsoft, what do we mean? So some of this, who was in the session, the keynote session today? This is from SQL, a good number of you. All right, so a couple of things we're going to, two of the things we're going to talk about, and I'll show you the agenda here in a second. Two of the things we're going to talk about are a duplicate, so we'll try to go through those, you know, try to bore you with those too much. But I do want to spend a little bit of time on this because if you start, for those that weren't in the keynote, if you look at the progression of SQL Server since 2000, really about 2008, 2012, you see kind of a pattern of the things that Microsoft has been focused on. Kind of three key main pillars or areas that Microsoft has been focusing on for SQL Server, right? So around 2008 R2 and 2012, they introduced cloud integration. They've always been focused on performance, so things like in 2014, in-memory OLTP, clustered column store, things like that, and then more of the the PowerView area in 2008 R2 and 2012. You see some of the how do I get better insights into my data? So there's always been how can I make things better and faster, more available, right? So the kind of the mission critical side of things, the cloud. And then better insight. So you really boiled these down to these three key main pillars, right? The mission critical, performance, and always on availability, high availability, deeper insights. So how can I make real-time decisions, from real-time insights into my data, and then the hyperscale cloud. Everybody gets, the first two, mission critical and deeper insights, because they understand that. We understand relational. But once we start getting into the cloud, look, cloud's been around for what? How long now? 5, 6, 7 years, a little bit. At least 5 years, somewhere about 6 or 7 years. People still have an issue with this. And we're not quite sure. And I think it's because, from a certain perspective, the DBAs all start panicking. Oh my goodness, I'm out of a job, right? And that's not true. But what we have to understand is, the cloud's here, and it's you can leverage this in many ways, right? And a lot of the things we're going to talk about really today are focused on the cloud. How can I leverage the cloud in a hybrid scenario? And why you should be thinking about the cloud in a hybrid scenario, right? In hybrid environments, okay? So our agenda today is the following. We're going to talk about these five things, right? And when I say top, I used to call this top five hybrid scenarios, right? It's not top five, it's not Microsoft's top five, it was Scott's top five, right? The kind of things that you should be thinking about. But these are the kind of the hybrid scenarios. And if you were in the keynote today, we talked about StretchDB and Polybase, we'll talk about those. Then we'll get in some interesting ones around high availability and disaster recovery with the cloud and why you should be thinking about that. And then we'll get into data backup, we'll get into, I think, backup to the cloud first, and then we'll talk about data files in the cloud, right? So we'll try to cover that in an hour. Are we good with that? All right, good. So let's get started. So with every single one of these, we're going to talk about the what, the high, the how, and the why. So what are they? How do you configure it? Definition and details. We'll talk about the how. How do you configure this? How do you set it up? And then the why, this is going to be a thinking session. Why really should you be thinking about hybrid? So when you leave the session, the goal is to go, I really need to be thinking about, not go home and slam all your production stuff into the cloud, but how you can start leveraging, how you might start thinking about leveraging SQL Server 2014 and 2016 in the cloud. Now, a lot of these, if you look, the last three have been around since SQL Server 2014, right? So we'll talk about, but the first two are new to 2016, okay? So even if you're running 2014, you can still leverage hybrid, right, with the last three. All right. So let's begin. Let's talk about StretchDB. And if you saw this morning, there's been, and I asked this morning, we see a lot of customers, with just bloated databases because they have their historical data in their database, right? And whether it's in the same table or where they move it, they have a completely separate history database or history tables. They're always, moving stuff off. They'll do ETL processes off. And or heaven forbid, they'll move their historical data to outside of SQL Server, outside of relational database, like Azure storage tables, because it's cheaper, right? And so they'll have to move things out. So they'll have a lot of these ETL processes to move data, back and forth. And there's times when you need to query that. So now you have to go back and go get that data, and or write some horrendous code to go, access the historical data. Wouldn't it be nice if you could have that at your fingertips and not have to worry about moving things around? And this is what StretchDB is. StretchDB says, we talk about warm and cold, right? You've got your OLTP data that you use. Let's say you've got, order data, and you constantly are working with orders for, the last year, and then everything over the last year or 2 years is we'll call historical. You move that, you may archive that off, right? Well, this says, look, I've got an order history table. I don't want to have to do any archival processing. I don't want to have to do any moving to a history table, things like that. But I still want access to that without any performance degradation. So what we're basically saying is we're going to take your cold data and stretch that one order table to the cloud, right? The beauty of this is it's cost effective, but I think the even better is this is transparent. No architecture changes to your application or the table, right? So it's completely 100% transparent to the user and to the application. All you're saying is, I want to move my data, or take my cold data, my historical data, and just stretch this one table to the cloud, right? The great thing, another thing about this is, how many of us have to, when we look at, start backing things up and archiving, have to go look at disk space and go, do I have enough disk space to do that, right? Things like we'll get to backup in a minute, because I know you do that on backups. Man, I got to back up. Do I have enough disk space to do that? Right. Same thing here. If I have got a historical data, I don't have to worry about, spend, outrageous amounts of money on SANs, right? But let me take my data and just stretch it out of the cloud where it's really endless storage, right? And much cheaper than you're paying for that SAN, right? So I'm basically saying, all right, let me move that. And then again, my application does not change. My T-SQL statements don't change. It's smart, SQL Server is smart enough to know that it'd say, hey, if I'm doing a query and part of the results are pulling data from my cold data, go get that, aggregate that data, and bring it back. So I don't have to change my application, my database, anything, right? It's completely 100% transparent. Okay? Make sense? Right? So the question is, and I know you guys are probably, those who are in the keynote this morning know the answer to this, but the question is, how do I set this up, and how hard is it, or how easy is it, really? Right? So let's just come out and show you a quick demo, right? Okay, so what I have here, so just like there's a couple things where we have to go, and first of all, it's very simple. So the first thing we have to do is we have to go tell our instance that we are going to enable for Stretch. Okay, so it's as simple as saying, okay, we're going to run spconfigure, set remote data archive to 1, done, right? So we're basically enabling everything for Stretch. Okay, so we're going to go enable for Stretch, we're done. At this point, we can go and say, all right, I want to go into my database and say, I want to stretch this database to the cloud, right? And so you're saying, well, what tables, what columns, things like that, right? So again, let me be very honest here. So I'm running SQL Server 2016 CTP 2.3, okay? This is released about 2 or 3 days ago, right? So what you see today may change. In fact, I got caught in the keynote because what we're going to walk through is different than from, I had 2.2 installed in here, and they changed it between 2.2 and 2.3, right? So what I want you to get out of this is the functionality, not the steps to get to where we're going. Okay. All right. So once we're done, we've set it. Okay. We're going to remote archive tasks, stretch, enable. Okay. And this starts with a very simple wizard, right? And you're saying, okay, well, how do I need, obviously we're stretching to Azure, so you need an Azure subscription, right? But it's very simple as we're going to go click next And it says, all right, well, what tables do I want to stretch into the data into the cloud? Now, you're probably asking, how granular can I get? Can I stretch specific columns? Right now, no. You're just basically saying, okay, what tables do I want to stretch into the cloud? So I'm going to say, I'm going to take expense report detail. Is that the one? Expense report detail. I'm going to stretch that. Right? And then it's going to say, all right, well, I need to, since I'm stretching to Azure, I need to log into Azure. So I'm going to click sign in real quick. I'm going to enter a password here. Once it authenticates, it's going to come back and say, all right, well, what's if you have multiple subscriptions, we'll give it a second. Oh, yep, I want that one. Thank you very much. All right. So it says, all right, we've authenticated. Now, I've got multiple subscriptions. So what subscription do you want to stretch this to? So I'm going to use my MSDN subscription. If you got a test subscription, doesn't matter. All right, what region do you want to stretch this to? So obviously from a latency perspective, performance perspective, you want to stretch this to the closest area to yours. So I think the closest data center is in Australia, right? It's not listed here, so I'm just gonna pick US West just for demo purposes, right? And then I can tell it, look, I've got an existing server in the subscription, let me just replicate to that. Or I can say create a new server, right? So I can say, hey, here's my servers. So what it'll do is actually go create a new database in my for me, and then stretch into that database. Or I can say, look, I just want to create a new server. So it'll actually go. I don't have to go pre-create anything. It'll create a server for me, create a database for me, and then stretch, right? And I just click next, right? And I can say, okay, what's going to create a new server? So let's go, Scott. Let's get username and password. Now, if you're familiar with Azure, it's going to say anytime you create an Azure SQL Database server, you know you have to specify firewall rules, right? These are the things that say who has access, right? So I have to say, okay, well, this needs access, so I can enter firewall rule. I'm not going to do that here. And then click next and go, right? The problem here is that the questions you're going to ask is, well, how do I know what's hot and cold, right? Right now, there's no way to specify, and they're working on this, there's no way to specify, well, cold means, let's say, 2013 or earlier, right? There's no way, they're working on that, okay? That's why I'm throwing out that disclaimer. What you're going to see today may change a little bit between CTP this and CTP3 and GA, things like that, right? But hopefully does this make sense, right? So what I've done is I just said, all right, I'm going to take data, my historical data, and at some point we'll be able to say, well, I want anything older than 2013, 2012. You know, how do I define what my cold data is, right? I can't do it on a column level yet, right? And you know, that could be, you know, you have to be also, do your homework first, right? Do I want to, if I'm stretching a table, am I going to stretch a table that has, you know, maybe some compliant, you know, credit card numbers, social security numbers, things like that, right? So maybe be careful what you're stretching into the cloud, okay? So again, it's just a matter of doing your homework. But here, basically, what we're saying is, now, if I have an application against this database, do I need to change my application? No, my application still works. I'm good to go. But I just saved a lot of money. Now, from a performance perspective, again, you know, you're also probably going to ask, well, you know, what's the performance on this? Okay, it depends. It depends on how much data you're pulling down. If you're, you know, the thing is, how many, you know, how often are you accessing historical data, right? So from a performance perspective, it's how much data you're pulling down, how often you're pulling it down, and how close you are to the data center, which for you would probably be Australia, okay? So this is a test to see what kind of performance you're gonna get out of it, but since it's historical data and you're probably not accessing historical data all the time, right, this is probably a very valid solution, okay? We good with that? All right, any questions? Yes? Can you measure performance? I'm trying to, can so you can through the DMVs to see, okay, you know, there's a new column in one that, you know, it's, I think it's sys.objects, sys.tables, it says this is a stretched table. But if you're wanting to monitor performance, right? This is, you know, there's nothing built in to say, hey, how do I, you know, how's my stretch table working, right? So, oh, actually, you know what? That's not true. So you can actually, the way to do this is to look at, when you execute your queries, look at the query plans, right? You can look at those, because you can kind of see how, because it'll say, I think there's a way, and I actually should have had a, that's a good question, I think I should have had a slide in here that shows, when it does a query plan, it says, hey, this is coming from on-prem tables, this is coming from your stretch table, right? When I say on-prem, the same table, right? But start looking at that. If you email me, I'll point you to some information about that. Okay, yeah. Oh, I didn't know that. Okay, there's a new wait state for that? Probably. Okay, good. Same way. So it backs up. So it'll back up the entire thing, right? Everything. Yep. So. So if my data is in the cloud and I want to query it. Yes. So you won't be able to connect. So let's say that you have connection issues to the cloud. That's a good question. So anytime you're dealing with cloud, you might run into connectivity issues. So if you're trying to pull data, query data that the cold data part of is in the cloud, and you're trying to query that, and you can't connect. You'll probably get an error back. I have not tried that, right? This is one of those things where you stretch it, you pull the network cord, and see what kind of error message you get back, right? So if it's not available, it's not available, it's coming back. So you're going to get an error message back, right? But you'll get the data that's hot. You will get the local data. Yeah. Yeah, it's not going to stop, because what it does is it goes out and gets the local, you know, gets the hot and the cold. You'll get the hot, right? Okay, any other questions? When we do re-indexing
tables,
yeah. How
does that work?
So again, this is just a table that we're stretching, right? Nothing changes, right? If you're still doing re-indexing and applying indexes, that's, you know, it's not like there's a completely separate table up there, right? What's that? It's a table. So nothing, you're not saying, hey, I query this table and this table. It's the same thing. So re-indexing, maintenance jobs, things like that still work because it's the same table, right? Yeah. So the question is, this environment is enabled for stretch, I back it up and restore to an environment. I have not tried that. That's a great question. More than likely, it would probably just restore the entire database locally, right? I bet. Don't quote me on that. I really don't know that. Right? One of some things I just haven't tried and tested yet, but it'll be good. So I know what I'm doing after this session. Okay. All right. Let's keep going. We good so far? All right, let's keep going. All right, the other one is Polybase, okay? Polybase has been around a while, but really what it is the ability to say, look, we've been doing SQL for a long time. We know relational, but if you look at where things are going, you know, what's the big trends over the last few years, right? Big data and Internet of Things, right? Which means it's just not relational anymore. We're dealing with data that is not relational, okay? Which means, oh my goodness, do we have to learn a whole new set of technologies to start working with this data? So what Polybase says is, in SQL Server 2016, can I work with this non-relational data in a way, in a tool that I'm familiar with, without having to learn kind of whole new SQL technologies like Scoop or, you know, HiveQL or, you know, Pig or things like that, right? And so what it is, it says, you know, let's through a single tool be able to start working with, you know, relational and non-relational at the same time. So within SQL Server 2016, I can query, say, I've got some non-relational data sitting out there. I've got relational data sitting in SQL Server 2016. I want to go and query both using T-SQL syntax. Okay. So think about it. And we'll talk about. I've got another session after this. We'll talk about this in more detail. But think about where data is going. Okay. Again, it's just not relational anymore. So I've got device data, sensor data, I've got weblog data, I've got all sorts of data, and we need to understand this data. So it's just not relational anymore. How do we start working with this data? How do we start processing this data? And so we can do that with SQL Server 2016. So I did this demo this morning, so if you've seen it before, let me cancel this. I apologize because you'll see it again. All right, same thing. So the first thing we need to do is we need to tell, I've got a database out there called Polybase, and there are no tables in this database, brand new table, right? But you'll notice that you have things like file tables and external tables, a new node, and then you also have down here called external resources, so data sources and file formats, okay? We're gonna start working with these. So the first thing we need to do, just like we did in the first demo, we need to turn this on, so we're gonna say, all right, let's go and tell, we're gonna do connectivity to a non-relational data source, so we're gonna execute that. And because we're using scoped credentials, in this example, we've got to enable this trace flag 4631, so we're going to enable that. Now, I'm going to be honest here, they're thinking about taking away, not having to do a scoped credential going forward, right? But because we're doing a scoped credential now, that's why we have to enable this trace flag. This is something that may change between now and GA. That's what they're talking about, okay? But for this example, this is the way it is, right? So now we're gonna go create a master key. And then because I'm accessing data that is in storage, so in this example, I've got, let me just fire this up real quick. Out here, I've got a file, and I showed this morning. I have a file sitting out in Azure Blob Storage. This Azure Blob Storage is I can't remember how big it is. Oops, blob containers. Out in here, an HCI example. It's not that big. It's, how big is it? About 11 meg. It's got about 270,000 rows in it. It's just, it's from the London Underground tube system. They call it the tube system, right? So when someone comes in and out of the tube, it takes that. So what I want to do is I'm going to use this file. And because it's sitting in Azure Blob Storage, I need to pass my credentials to that to authenticate to this Azure Blob Storage. So I need to go and authenticate. So we need to set this, create a credential that specifies the credentials to my Azure Blob Storage account. Okay. And then what I'm going to do is I'm going to create an external data source. Right. And this external data source says, hey, it's type Hadoop. And here's the location. I'm simply specifying the path to that text file. It's just simply a CSV file, comma separated file, right? And I'm using the credentials to authenticate to that. So let me run that. Then what I'm doing is I'm actually creating a create external file format. This just says, if anybody's familiar with HiveQL, you create an external table, and in that same statement, you're saying, hey, it is a, external file format, and it's comma separated, it's tab delimited, things like that. This is what I'm doing here. I'm just saying, here's the file, it's comma separated, right? So I'm doing that. And then what I'm gonna do is I'm gonna create an external table. Now this external table, notice the keyword external, right? I'm not saying create table, I'm saying create external table. So if I run this, and notice what it is, so it's got the structure of, if I were to take a look at that text file, you'll notice all the columns, it's got the same structure as those columns, right? And then I'm saying, okay, that now in location, go to that path and get this file, use the data source that we just created using this file format that we just created. So we'll create this text file. If we go into our external sources again, external tables again, let's refresh that. There's our external table. Now the question is, pop quiz really quick, did that actually create a disk-based table like we normally know on SQL Server? No, what did it do? It's really just a reference, right? Because if you think about how Hadoop works, right? It doesn't store, it's basically metadata. So it basically applies the schema on read. So this says, here's the format and the data types that when I pull my data down, okay? When I query my data. You could think of it like a view, but right? It's just the structure of what am I file, right? And that has to match this table down here, right? So what I'm saying is I'm gonna say now select into, I don't have sucked into station. Notice that that station table does not exist. Because what it's going to do is I say select into, it's actually going to create in SQL Server my station table. Then I can say select star from station, right? So I've created that, and if I just execute this, now this morning it worked, but then it threw an error, but it did work. So what it's doing is we go back here to my tables and refresh my tables a second. I'm just going to let it finish, because maybe that's what it did. All right, but does this make sense what we're doing? We're basically saying, I've got non-relational data out there that's in a whatever type of format. This is just happens to be, for a simple example, a CSV, right? I want to go query that data and pull it down into a relational database, right? Someone this morning asked if we could go the other way, not through this system, but if you're familiar with Scoop, right? In my session after this, we'll talk about Scoop. Scoop, I can actually import and export data using Scoop between a non-relational and relational database, okay? Okay, let's see if we can refresh my table without it bombing. Okay. And then what it's doing is simply pulling down data. So we'll give this a second. Any questions? Yeah, so you look quick. Yeah, so at this point I'll just do select star from table and I'm done. Is that what you're asking? Yeah, actually, so I have it at a table and I could actually do a join, right? That's the purpose, you know, the goal is to say I got to query this, and if I need to do, you know, aggregation, things like that, okay? All right, any other questions? All right, we'll actually come back to this, we'll let it finish. This didn't take this long this morning, so. All right, so let's keep going, if there's no other questions. All right, why? All right, so this is the why. So ad hoc queries against Hadoop data, we just say Hadoop, but this could be any kind of non-relational data. You know, import data from Hadoop Azure Storage Account for SQL Server processing, pretty easy. If I need to do BI integration, if I want to export data from SQL Server to Hadoop, so there's your export question, but it's not through this way, right? It's, I think there's another way I have to do that. So if I can find an example of that. Right, but simply it's hopefully you understand this. The ability to simply say I'm going to take relational data and non-relational data and query those easily through SQL Server. Okay, we good with that? All right, let's go on to disaster recovery. All right, this one is not new to 2016, but we're going to they've made some changes to it in 2016, but it's really the same concept. Okay, this is the ability to say. So let me ask you this: how many of you have in your environment have a primary data center and a secondary data center, right? How much do you spend for that secondary data center? Way too much, right? How often do you use that secondary data center? Now I'm not talking just about from replicating data from point A to point B for DR scenarios, but how often do you use that secondary center for things other than that? Most of them, nobody ever raises their hand, right? So you're paying a lot of money for nothing, right? And I shouldn't say nothing. It's, hey, if something happens to your primary data center. So if you're familiar with, a few years ago, I think it was Hurricane Sandy. Typically in the United States, when a hurricane forms in the Atlantic, you know, it has its eyes on two areas of the United States. You know what they are? Texas and Florida, right? For some reason, it's just, hurricanes have, that's where they're going. So most of them will hit like Florida or skirt under Florida and then, take on Texas and Louisiana. Or they'll hit Florida and just a little, maybe Georgia, right? But Hurricane Sandy, if you're familiar, did what? You guys familiar with that? It said, forget you, I'm going to go way up the coast of the East Coast, and where did it land? New York, right? Still a hurricane, hit New York, wiped out New York. Right, and a lot of the companies had their primary and secondary data centers in that area, so a lot of these companies were down a while. Okay, so if you're paying a lot of money for a secondary data center and you're not using them, why are we putting them on prem? And so what this disaster recovery hybrid scenario says, I'm going to use Azure for my secondary data center. Okay, and let's walk through this. Right, so I still have in this environment, I still have my primary. My primary and some secondaries on-prem, but I'm going to put one or more secondaries in the cloud, okay? And we'll talk about how we do that in a second. So simply it's, hey, what it is, so I'm, just like any other, it simply is doing HA like you would on-prem, right? So I'm sitting always on availability groups, like just like I would configure that on-prem, I'm just putting some of my secondaries in the cloud, right? Now, there are some things that we may need to talk, that you may need to consider. For example, there's some countries like I think Germany and France and others who say, I can't have data outside the borders of my country, right? So, or maybe latency issues, things like that, okay? Other things like, okay, what's supported? So, in this scenario, we support these. So availability groups, database mirroring, log shipping, you can do all this in these technologies. If I'm going to highly recommend availability groups because of the multiple secondaries, the multiple readable secondaries, the automatic failover, and the readable secondaries, right? Just always on availability groups makes sense. Okay. How is this done? Okay. So it's very, anybody set up always on availability groups? 2012, 2014? Yeah, okay. It's just like that, right? Very simple to do. Unlike database mirroring, we have to do one database at a time. Availability group says, okay, I'm going to do multiple databases, done. Very simple. If you want to know how to do this, there's a couple white papers. We're going to show you this. Simply, and I've got a picture of my environment, there's a way to do this. Configure SQL Server technology as on-premise. There's a white paper out. It's actually a blog post out there that walks you through how to do this. Everything's up in Azure, right? So you just take that white paper, that blog post, and just say, okay, the only difference is you're putting some of your primaries and secondaries on-prem, okay? If you take that blog post and paste that into a Word document, it's 98 pages, okay? 98 pages. Pretty pictures and everything. Walks you through step by step on how to set these environments up. If you mess this up, you're in the wrong business, right? You cannot mess this up, right? It walks you through step by step by step, right? If you want to set this up, do a database mirroring, things like log shipping, there they are. And it does require like a VPN device. So very simple, you're just creating a secure connection, because what I'm doing is I'm taking that one or more Azure VMs and through my VPN tunnel, just domain joining those to my on-prem domain. Simple as that, right? Then I'm setting up always on availability groups just like I would on-prem, okay? So I've got my on-prem environment where my primaries and multiple secondaries, and I've got one or more secondaries in Azure through my VPN tunnel. That's as simple as it is. So this is my environment in my office, and it's a mess because we just moved offices. So I had to throw this up before I came on my trip, and I had to put that sign on there that says, look, don't remove this because I need this for a demo, okay? Now, so on my box is the PC is my domain controller, and on this, you'll see on that, external hard drive, you see I've got some VMs on there, and that's my Windows Server Failover cluster and my primary and secondary, okay? That's what I've got. And that goes out through that box on the ground that the paper's taped to, that's my Cisco 5505 VPN device, okay? It was $300, so pretty cheap, okay? Then what I did is I just set that up, created it, and then I put my VM. So let's walk through on how this actually works. Okay, so let's jump over to 8. Okay, so this is a multi-step process, right? So the first thing I needed to do is I needed to go into Azure and I say, all right, I needed to create a virtual network. So I created my things on-prem first. We're not going to walk through that, right? But at that point, what I need to do is say, all right, I need to create a virtual network. And first thing I did is I created a local network and said, all right, well, my local network and the VPN gateway is the IP address that's out, right? So I have what's called a DTAP line in my office that's not on the corporate network. That's just out to the public, right? And that's the IP address they gave me. So that's my local network, local gateway, right? I then created a virtual network, and my virtual network simply says, I've got down here, there is my, where's it at? Oh, let's go to configure, right? And there is right there. So I created a virtual network space, and I created a whole some subnets and said, this is my subnet space. Okay, just set that up, applied the local network. Okay, and then essentially at that point said, all right, now let me go into Azure and create my VPN device, or create my Azure. So here in Azure, I've got this virtual machine is running SQL Server 2000, running SQL Server, okay? And this is domain join. So once I did that, I had to go into the VPN device, I had to configure the VPN device so that this network is talking to this network, right? Simple as that. And at that point, I can go back into I can see that things are good because in my disaster recovery, in my virtual network, where's my virtual network? Right, in my DR, I can see things that are connected. So I know that my scooter DR and my scooter local are talking. So my gateway and my VPN are communicating. So everything's, you know, green and blue connected. I know things are, and I got data in and out, okay? So I know things are communicating, all right? So things like this. So what I can do now is I can go up to my virtual machine. Let's connect to my virtual machine up in the cloud. So let me ask you this while this is firing up. All right, So if you need to scale an Azure VM, how do you scale an Azure VM? So let's say I've got this VM in the cloud, right? How do I scale that? Let's say something happens to my on-prem environment. How do you, something happens on-prem, how do you scale your environment on-premises, right? Versus, what does it take to scale an Azure VM in the cloud? If something happens to my on-prem domain, how easy is it to scale my on-prem environment? What's that? It's super simple, right? Just move the slider. I need X amount of instances, so I move the slider, and then I can change the VM size too, right? So if something happens to my on-prem domain, I simply RDP into this box, do a manual failover, and my users are still up and running, right? So let's just walk through a very quick demo here. So command. I don't know if you guys can see that. So if I say IP config all, right, you guys can see that I am domain joined, right? So there is scooter.local, I'm connected to scooter.corp.com or corp.scooter.com, right? So everything's good there, right? So there's my Scooter SQL 3, I'm connected to my on-prem domain. Right, and if I wanted to, I can say, all right, well now let me go in here and say, all right, let me see if I can ping. So I can say ping SQL 1, which is my one of the primaries. So you can see that I am getting feedback from my primary on-prem. Okay, and if I wanted to, right, just I think for time, we're gonna keep going here. But this is the ability to say, all right, now if I want to, always on, I can check my availability groups. I can, right. Right now, my primary is SQL 1, so I can go into the availability group, manual failover to SQL 3, and I'm good to go, right? I could RDP into SQL 1, insert a record in SQL 1, see it replicated to SQL 3, no problem, because it always has that async replication, so this is always up to date, right? But all I did was say, all right, I'm going to take I'm going to take my environment, and I'm going to get rid of my secondary data center, and Azure is now going to become my secondary data center, because in this scenario, to scale, right? If I go into here, okay, I can easily say I want a bigger machine, more cores, more memory, or I want more instances of this machine. So to support the user load, I simply go into here, move the slider, say I need not one instance, but I need 10 instances of this machine, and I may go from an A3 to an A7 or a D series or things like that, right? So very easily support the load if I need to do a manual failover. Okay, questions? Does this make sense? Yeah, fairly self-explanatory. Okay. All right, we good so far? All right. All right, let's keep going. Oh, yeah. All right, so here's let's talk about the whys now for this. Okay, so this is why. Again, we have to be able to protect ourselves from things like either temporary or permanent issues where like flooding, hurricane comes through, the cleaning person knocks out the power cord of the server, things like that. That's happened before. And really, the reason I asked about this is because, we spend a lot of money on that secondary data center, but we're really not using it as it is meant to be used, right? This where we say, okay, this is, I'm using Azure as my secondary center. And so how much did that VM, I got one VM, it's I think an A3, right? How much is that VM costing me a month in Azure? Heck of a lot less than my secondary data center, right? And that's the answer. I think this is probably costing me 35, 40, 50 bucks, right? Versus the tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands a month I'm paying for that secondary data center. Now, this isn't a, hey, go get rid of your secondary data center immediately, but this is here's something to think about because it's much cheaper, I think much more efficient because that in Azure, right, I actually have a duplicate of that VM, right? So I have multiple copies of that VM just to get everything's in triplicate, right? So I've got that ability. Now, also, why are we doing this? So we could also use this as well if we want to, from a hybrid scenario, create multiple VMs that are attached to our on-prem domain. we can actually use that as an ability to offload some of our workload into Azure. So instead of spinning up other PCs on-prem, say, you know what, I've got this big workload I need to run. Let me just spin up or turn on my Azure VMs, offload my workload to Azure, and then when I'm done, I can turn off those VMs. So things like that, right? So again, offload reworkloads to Azure or processing, offload those to Azure. I can actually back up to Azure, so use these as backup scenarios to Azure, things like that. Just a note, it does require a Windows domain, right, and the VPN device, right? So, all right. Any questions? We got make sense? Thoughts? All right. Keep going? All right. So, backup to cloud. Backup to cloud is an interesting one, right? And I asked this, how many of you have to say, go look for disk space, make sure you have enough disk space to go before you start backing up your databases? Right? How many of you are afraid to answer that question? Right? A lot of us have to go look, say, okay, I'm gonna need to back up my database. Do I need to go, delete old archives of backups, things like that, right? Same thing, disks is expensive, so I need to be able to back that stuff, So why don't I use something that's very much less expensive and I don't have to go check disk space, right? This is where we say we're gonna back up to the cloud, okay? So in backup to the cloud, this is very simple. I'm going to, instead of backing up to a disk, I'm simply going to back up to Azure. Right? Why would I do that? So let's talk about the what first. So why do we back up? Let's talk about why we back up first. Why do we back up? What's that? DR, right? What else? What's that? Corruption of data. So typically, in my opinion, others may disagree, but we back up for several reasons, right? And it really boils down to two or three main reasons, right? We're backing up to protect our data, right? For whatever reason, for DR, we had some rogue developer do a delete without aware clause on our data, right? Oops recovery. A lot of times we back up because we simply want to, be able to do our QA and testing on production data. So we'll back that up and load our data into our test environments, right? But I think, it really boils down to, those kind of scenarios, because we're really not, we have to be able to recover, and it's just, recovery scenarios, right? So it's not that we're, restoring, there are cases where we need to restore more frequently, but for the most part, we're not restoring that often. Is that true statement? Okay. So, others may, I think there's scenarios where we are restoring more frequently, but I think we're 90% of the time we're not restoring that much. So, when we back up, we're backing up, we're not really considering, we really don't need to consider, for the most part, restoring that data, right? So this talks, backup restore times, but if I kick off a backup, how many of us actually just sit there and watch to make sure our backup succeeds, right? It's typically a fire and forget, right? Right, and then we check our logs or wait for that alert to say our backup failed, right, or things like that. So, but what we are concerned about is the restore times, right? But to me, that's not too much of an issue because it's not like we're restoring every day or that frequently. Okay, so this chart just basically says, look, if we're backing up, since we're backing up to the cloud and restoring, we can say restoring from the cloud. There are some latency things we have to consider, but if we're going to backup, restore from the cloud, typically I'm not restoring from the cloud. I'm going to take that backup, download it, and then restore that backup locally. Okay. This is extremely simple, right? Just like again, this is Azure. So the things we knew is we need an Azure account, we need a storage account, and then we can do this several ways, right? So we're going to create this using T-SQL, SMO, or PowerShell. Okay. You can automate some of this, but if you're doing this T-SQL or SMO or PowerShell, this is how you do it. It can't get any more easier than this, okay? So with that, we'll just jump out and we'll do another demo, okay? So, all right. So here we are. So again, I've got my cloud storage, but it's not that hard. This is all the syntax it takes to back up to the cloud. If you think about this and boil this down to something very simple, it's the only change here is that I have to get, just like in our Polybase demo, remember we had to create credentials to our Azure storage, because anytime you're, you know, from a security perspective, we have to be authenticate to Azure Blob Storage, right? We don't want it, just anybody getting access to that. So again, I'm creating a credentials to be in which to back up, right? And then what I'm going to do is, instead of saying, okay, backup database, database name, instead of saying, you know, to path, right, I'm backing up to a Blob Storage account. That's it, okay? Simple as that, okay? So what I'm gonna do is, let's run through this real quick, and I'm gonna back up, let's go to the Contoso Expense database, okay? And let's go to this. So we're gonna go master first, and we're gonna create a credential. I don't think, if this fails, I should've checked, if this fails, it's because, let's go to security, make sure my credential doesn't exist yet. Nope, not there. There's my stretch credential, right? So we should be good here. So let's run that. Okay, we can refresh our credentials. So there's my cloud credential. I don't think I've changed this password, so this actually should work. So what I'm going to do is, I'm going to run just backup and backup this database to the cloud. Okay, and this database isn't that long. So when we talk latency, there's a couple of things we have to take in consideration, right? Okay, so done already, right? But you're going, well, that was fast. Yeah, that was fast because this database is probably less than 1 meg, right? It's not that big, right? So when we talk latency, there's a couple of things we have to think about, right? One is, how big is your database, okay? And two is just the pipe you got to the network, right? Anytime you're dealing with the cloud, let's be completely honest here, anytime you're dealing with the cloud, you gotta think of a few things. So the size of your database and your bandwidth, your pipe to the internet, right? Okay, and this is why we say test. Okay, test it, right? Now, so I can go back out here to, where did we put this? I went out to backpack. So let's go to the backpack. There it is, Contoso Expense, where's today's date? Should be there. Doing, it's gotta be there somewhere because it said it succeeded. All right, you have to trust me that it succeeded because it's there. What did it call it? Mm-hmm. Unless it, I probably just overwrote it. Anyway, all right. So, and now let me ask you this real quick. So notice that in the syntax here, it said, I didn't say Contoso Expense dot back, I said dot backpack. What's the difference? What's that? Yeah, so you guys familiar with the DAC framework? Right, the DAC framework's over the DAC, a DAC pack. What's a DAC pack? It's kind of a little zip or an artifact that contains the schema of your data, right? You can actually crack it open and see things kind of encrypted in there. If you think about a backpack is that same artifact, but includes data as well. You can actually crack it open and see everything zipped up and compressed in there and, you know, encrypted, so you can't actually see the data. But this is how, when we want to, so, you know, if I wanted to now take this data and restore it, I'd go back to, if I wanted to restore this locally, I'd go into my database and I'd say Contoso Expense. See, they changed this tasks. Where's import data to your application? God, they move things around. All right, so I'd say some probably import data, or, you know, there used to be an import data to your application. So what it says, I'm going to import that backpack, right? So, and it says, you know, the challenge here, and let's just be completely honest, right? The challenge here is this is simply a full backup, right? There's no way to do differential or transactional backups. This is simply a full backup. So if you still need that differential and transactional, you'll still got to do your normal backups. Okay? Make sense? All right, but same thing, I just right mouse click import, or, you know, I can export the same way, export data to application, and you can still get that backpack. Okay. This is 14 and 16. Right? I can't remember if it works on 12. Yeah, I'd have to go back and look. I haven't done it on 12, so I can't remember. But at least 14 and 16. So I want to say, well, go look. I honestly can't remember. I haven't done 12 in a while. All right. All right, so why are we doing this? And again, this is the why, okay? Near bottomless storage. We say near bottomless storage. I mean, you've got a cap. You can, you know, but you know, this is, you know, you're only paying. You can have terabytes and terabytes of data. So, you know, I shouldn't say near. This is almost bottomless storage, right? And how much does it cost to store a 1 gig file in Azure? Anybody know? For 30 days. Anybody know a 1 gig file? About 7 cents, right? So about 7 cents. I don't know what it is in New Zealand dollars, but let's say anywhere between 7 to 9 cents per gig per month, right? So it's a heck of a lot cheaper to back up to have storage in the cloud than it is on-prem, right? And that price actually goes down the more data you store up on the cloud, okay? So you get price breaks based on quantity, right? Now, again, so if you're doing this on-prem, do you get free offsite and geo-redundant backups? No, right? You have to do that yourself. But in Azure, when I back that up, how many copies of that backup did I get? Three, at least three, right? So I got one, depending if I have geo-redundant or local redundant set up on my Azure storage account, right? But at least I have three copies, and maybe if I have geo-redundant, one of those copies is in a completely different data center, okay? So again, I got HA built into my backups already, right? Don't have to provision anything. No device management. I don't have to, you know, like we do when we do backup, we have managed backup devices. I don't have to manage any backup devices because, you know, Azure does that for me. And remote accessibility, because it's in the cloud, I can get to this stuff anywhere, right? Which is awesome, right? So I think there's benefits to that. Forever. For this one, it's however long it's up there, right? Until you delete it. So the question is, what's the retention period? Now, one of the things I wasn't planning on talking about, this is manual backup. We have one that's called, I just forgot the word. It's like enhanced backup or automated backup, right? Automated backup, let me just throw a teaser out there a little bit. We have one that's called automated backup that was introduced in SQL Server 2014, right? And this automated backup was automated, meaning I could set it up, but it only backed up based on the activity of your data, right, of your database. So if there was no activity, it backed up less frequently. If there was a lot of activity, it backed up more frequently. That has a retention of 30 days max, okay? So this is, but the problem is, the automated backup has a retention, but it's set up, there's a script, and if you email me, I can send you the script, but it's set up in MSDB. There's no UI, you run the script, you basically turn it on, turn it off. That's it, turn it on, turn it off, okay? You can encrypt the backup, but that's it, right? And it essentially, once it's on, it monitors the activity of your database, and the more activity there is, the more frequently it backs up, right? But it has a limit. So after 30 days, a garbage collection goes through and starts deleting things after 30 days. This, forever, until you go and delete it, okay? So you gotta be careful. Now again, from a cost perspective, storage, it's cheap, but again, if you're, depending on how frequent you're backing up and your backups are kind of large, you could still start, you know, things could start adding up. Can I incorporate this into a maintenance plan? Yeah, I don't see why not. Yeah. You'd have to think about, naming file conventions and things like that, right? Because in this case, I think it may not have written because I already had a Contoso expense backup in there, so it either appended to that or, you know, I haven't tested, but this is, you have to think about when you're doing automated, what does that mean? So as you're backing up, you know, naming convention, because you're backing up to the same thing with the same file name, so you'd have to, you know, work around that, which is doable. I've not done a maintenance tag. This should be doable, right? So if I have not done a maintenance tag that actually reaches into Azure to delete, right? So I don't know if that capability is there. So that's my second piece of assignment I'll do after this. Oh yeah, you can definitely do it in PowerShell, right? You can almost do anything in Azure in PowerShell, but you can definitely do that in PowerShell. All right. Right, last topic. We got 5 minutes. This is one where when I talk about this, you all go, no, not happening, right? Because for several reasons, and we'll get into that, right? So this essentially says, I think what I want you to take away from this one is just think about it, right? Or think about the benefits, or think about in what scenario you might implement something like this, right? But again, So in the last example, we backed up our database. Database was on premises. We backed it up to Azure, right? Our backpack, right? This is different. This says when I do a create database statement, where am I putting my MDF? Where am I putting my data files? In the cloud, right? I'm actually putting my data files in the cloud. Now there's actual benefits to this. Things like, you know, I'm basically saying, hey, I'm going to take a database. The database looks, you know, it's in SQL Server Management, so it's there. But you look at properties, and it lists, you know, your Azure Blob storage path. Well, the benefit of this is things like, hey, I can actually, if I want to, create my database, disconnect, you know, detach that from one server, go to another server, and say, well, let me reattach that data. So that data can go wherever I go. Okay. Got to think about that a minute. It's not just, you know, it's not that, whoo, I'm going to go do that, right? Because you have to think about things like, you know, again, latency. You have to think about things about security. Am I going to put my entire database, you know, what type of data am I putting into the cloud, right? Very simple. This is the same. This is just T-SQL only. But it's really the same way. It's, I'm going to create a... create my database, I'm going to create credentials, and I'm going to store it up in Azure, okay? Let me jump out here real quick.
Can you split
files? Can some be local, some be local? No, in this scenario, no, because you're basically saying put my MDF and LDF files in.
But if you have more...
5 minutes, thank you.
If you have more files to your database...
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah, so I have multiple days. Yes, I think you can actually do that.
That
would be an alternative to that. So if you did partitioning, was what you're saying? Yes, partitioning. Yeah, you could actually have some in the cloud and some on-prem. You could actually do that. So there's no way around that. Thank you for bringing that up. Yeah, you can do that.
The stretch, you have to bring all your data down every time you back it up. It brings all your data back down.
Yeah. That's a good question. Yes and no. So I'm going to somewhat argue with that. I think there's certain scenarios where I would use stretch and some scenarios where I would use, table partitioning. So I get what you're saying, right? Because, yes, if I'm going to back up, you know, I got some latency backing up and things like that, right? But I think that there's some, I think there's some cases where you could probably see, you know, one being used in one case, one being used in the other case. You'd have to, you know, try both, is I think what I'm saying, right? All right, yeah. No. Yeah. There's no, I don't think there's any limit. I'm unaware of any limit, blob size limitation.
2 terabyte?
That's right. So yeah, per blob. Right, so at that point, yeah, you could probably do table, you know, more blobs. All right, so I'm not going to run this because we're only got 2 minutes left. But here's the difference in this one. It's the same thing, and I can walk you through this. But this is very simple. In this case, again, I have to create Azure Blob Storage. That's what's called a shared access signature. And what this does is it says, hey, I need to go into whatever tool I use. I used this one, which. Azure Management Studio, and I create what's called a shared access signature. And the shared access signature is really, you know, I've got multiple levels of security when I go to Azure Blob. I can create, you know, I got the key, the account name and the account key. But I can also get more granular by creating a shared access signature, saying, all right, you know, Tina only has read access and maybe only has read access to this specific blob or blob container for this amount of time. I can get very granular as to who has access to what for what amount of time. That's what this shared access signature does. So I create a shared access signature, and notice that when I do that, I create my shared access signature, and I just create my database. And I can see my credential, but I'm simply saying create database, and I'm specifying my MDF and my LDF to go to Azure Blob Storage and not to local disk, right? And it looks and behaves just like some other database. So if you're doing things like backups, I can still back up, and I'm pulling data down again and things like that. But this is kind of a one where, you know, when you leave here, just think about it a minute. Just think, you know, don't immediately, you know, toss this aside like, hey, there's nothing. But, you know, think about, you know, maybe some cases where you'd use this. Okay. So again, you know, bottomless storage, things like that. But let me recap. So what we did is we talked about some interesting scenarios, right? We talked about StretchDB, and I think there's like this gentleman set up here. I think there's some cases where, you know, where do we use StretchDB? You know, this is more for if I got historical cold data, and I think that's the difference, right? StretchDB is meant for, I have data that I'm not accessing a lot. Maybe I put that up there, or maybe, you know, I do my main partition, you know, things like that. You have to experiment on what's kind of, from a performance perspective, works better, right, in those scenarios. We talked about Polybase. So Polybase, how do I use a single tool to query relational and non-relational data, right? And then all this, this non-relational is coming from everywhere, not just, you know, on-prem. And then I think one of the key takeaway here is I think this disaster recovery scenario, right? Where, you know, we spend a lot of money on the secondary data center. I think there's benefits if we were just to kind of experiment and look at how can we leverage the cloud to start, moving some of our workload off to the cloud or even doing DR to the cloud, right? Because I think there's, you know, not a lot of, you know, with the asynchronous replication, you know, I think there's benefit to that, right? Because our data is still safe, right? All right, so anyway, thanks for coming. Whoop, I forgot to remove that. Thanks for coming. Any questions? I'll be around for a few minutes. I got to run into my other session, but any questions? This make sense? Was this helpful? Okay, good. Thank you. Appreciate it.